Hello and welcome. It's episode 76 of Campbell Conversations with your host, Colin Campbell. And today's conversation, we are joined by Fergus Crawley, the hybrid athlete and founder of The Modern Mind. This is a raw, inspiring and thoughtful conversation about men's mental health, purpose, the education system, as well as some incredible feats of endurance that Fergus has performed within his life. This is all brought to life by Fergus's own candid story that he shares with us in an effort to get us to have more conversations with those around of us. Fergus is somebody that has completed some incredible feats of endurance, and we dive into some of those, including the fact that Fergus became just the second athlete in history to back squat 500 pounds and run a sub 5 minute mile all in the same day. The fact that he finished this challenge off with running a full marathon just hours later pretty much sums up Fergus's ability and capacity in this space. We learn where Fergus's drive comes from with these endurance challenges and how he's raised almost £100,000 for Movember. Lastly, expect to find out the closest that Fergus has ever come to quitting during one of these challenges, as well as the anchors he has in place within his busy life to maintain his well-being while working towards such significant feats. This is certainly an area that many of us could listen to and take something from as we balance our hectic lives, albeit with slightly less challenging physical feats than Fergus goes through. Today's podcast is supported by Factory Weights. Factory Weights are a business that I've been working with now for just under 6 months, and I'm delighted to say that they continue to provide high quality, durable, and a cost-effective gym equipment for you, whether you're training at home, whether you're setting up a studio, or whether you just want some bits and pieces to help you with your rehab, your prehab, or whatever you're working on at this time. You can get high-quality gym and fitness equipment at an affordable price with next-day delivery for just £3. Factory Weights are heavy on quality but light on price, and you can get a further discount using the code COLL10 at checkout when you visit factoryweights.co. UK. That'll be linked in the show notes below. But before we dive into this episode, I just want to say a massive thank you once again for your continued support. This is an episode that I would love to see people starting more conversations off the back of. That's Fergus's main MO. It's one of his biggest aims with The Modern Mind, to drive conversations amongst us. And I thoroughly enjoyed recording this one. It was another one that was recorded in person at the podcast rooms in Glasgow. So hopefully you enjoy the superior quality that I brought to you on this one. And please keep up the support. Share it with a friend, pop it on your Instagram story, and let's keep growing Campbell Conversations to drive us to have more compelling conversations with each other too. Enjoy this one. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Cambro Conversations. In today's conversation, we are joined by Fergus Crawley. Fergus is the founder of The Modern Mind and a man that is encouraging us to have more conversations. What a better way to have conversations than in the podcast room in Glasgow and with this high quality equipment. So hopefully you're enjoying the crisp audio that's coming your way. Fergus, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here. And I can confirm the audio is crisp.
Please with ourselves. Zoom does the job, and you and I were talking before we hit record about the fact that during the pandemic I was very much bashing the recordings out over Zoom, and that did a job. But it's nice when you can get together with somebody that's based in Scotland as well, sit down and just chat, and it's a lot more informal as well.
It is. I think it'd be rude not to in Scotland, because I often laugh at the fact that Edinburgh and Glasgow in reality are so close together, but you'd never just think to pop through. Like when I lived in London, Finsbury Park to Brixton, for example, was 40 minutes on the tube, and I'd pop there to see my mate for a pint. Whereas you'd never think, yeah, I'm going to jump on the train from Queen Street to Haymarket and go for a pint with my mate, would you?
48 minutes in the train from
there. I know. Yeah. But no, happy to be here. Second time in Glasgow in the past fortnight, which is rare for me, but yeah, glad to be sitting down with you.
Yeah, fantastic, Fergus. And so I've introduced you there as the founder of The Modern Mind, and we were joking before we hit record about how on earth do we introduce a man that has his finger in so many pies, but equally, there is a bit more alignment now than there has been in the past in terms of what you're doing. Like everything's now feeding towards one area. What is that one area, would you say?
To be succinct, interesting question. I think the past 3 years I've kind of been on this accidental trajectory towards focusing on hybrid performance from a training point of view, using that as a method of communication for people pushing their boundaries, which also ties in with the mental health and general mindset conversations that I like to push from a messaging point of view because of the experience in my past that we'll talk about, I'm sure. But generally speaking, everything is now seen from the same hymn sheet, which is just encouraging people to be a bit more open-minded in simple terms, whether that's to training, whether that's to their own mental health, whether that's to their horizons, whether that's to their job, whether that's to their relationships. I've made a series of mistakes over my short life so far that I don't feel like I'm particularly qualified to give advice, but I just share what I have learned, and sometimes it sticks, sometimes it doesn't, but here we are.
I think that self-awareness piece is important as well, given that you're not holding yourself up as the oracle or the answer to all questions. Yep. But speaking from experience is definitely helpful. Like, I don't know about you, but if when you were younger looking at training, for example, you probably were looking at people that were a few steps ahead of you on the roadmap and maybe experienced more things down the line. You're like, right, okay, maybe I'll look to implement what he's doing. And it can be the same when it comes to mindset, same when it comes to business. And you're not necessarily looking for somebody that is the oracle that knows absolutely everything. You're just looking for somebody that's a bit further down that line that you can be like, right, okay, well, he's experienced this and this, and he's done this and this moving forward. Maybe I can replicate some of that. So it's almost better that you're more relatable from a perspective of, yes, I've made the mistakes, here's how I've moved forward, here's some of the structures and the processes that I put in place now, than if you were coming out and being like, guys, I'm 25, 26 years old.
I have all the answers, yeah, which you do see, and I despise personally, but it's... Yeah, as you've said, I think there's a big experience versus qualification discussion in the professional and the non-professional world, and it's one that I think is massively confused in many ways still, because both are valid in their own sense, but only in their application. And qualifications are useless if there's no context behind them or no application that goes anywhere. For example, I've heard many, many corporate talks from people with multiple academic qualifications, PhDs, that give no real tangible value to the people hearing them because there's no context or relatability behind the information that's being given. Whereas inversely, I've heard talks from people that have no academic qualifications in the content that they're talking about, but they have valid experience that gives the people listening something to relate to and something to understand. And that's ultimately why I've created the Modern Mind, or the next stage of the Modern Mind anyway, because I personally feel that in our current societal climate, people respond much more to people than they do to the information that they're being given. And experience validates qualification, but qualification doesn't validate experience, is the way that I view it.
I think a lot of my experience as well mirrors what you've said there in terms of that reassurance that somebody's been there and done it. Like, you can walk the walk, talk the talk, etc., etc., and all these phrases we can throw about all day.
Skin but they actually bit, have to skin mean, in the game. Yeah.
They have to mean something, don't they? And I completely agree. Like, when you have somebody in to speak to you within your office, and you're like, right, okay, this guy's legit because he's done this and this, but equally if somebody just pulls out their qualification sheet and then expects you to show some respect for it, then it's
the same old, isn't it? Like, you can't expect, I think one of the traps that I fell into, and we'll go into a bit more, is the linear progression that we all go through as human beings in the Western world. I mean, I can only speak for the education system in the UK, but we go through this step-by-step process of through school, qualification here, qualification there, go to university potentially, qualification there, which then you'll hand to an employer on your CV saying, here I am, one of thousands of people with the same piece of paper that says the same thing, give me a job in the area that we're all applying for. You need to differentiate yourself when that qualification is handed over, otherwise you're just the same as everyone else. So I think, it sounds like I could be bashing qualifications here, but I think we're sometimes too dogmatic in putting all our faith in a piece of paper, a certificate, when in reality, walking the walk, having experienced those things and actually applying the learnings of the qualifications that we operate within are what's more valid. And I can speak to that from personal experience. I mean, my degree is in theology and religion, and that qualifies me to have pretty profound conversations a few pints deep. But beyond that, it's useless. Like, I'm not afraid to say it's useless, but all it was here's a university certificate that I can hand over to an employer on a CV. And I didn't get my job because of that certificate. My original corporate job with Heineken, I got it because of the other stuff that I do. And every conversation I've had with professionals that I personally admire since then, they haven't been scrutinizing the details of my CV and the little dotted I's and crossed T's and, well, when did you complete that qualification and what were you doing at the time? It was a case of, oh, well, that's interesting. Great, you've got that. That's the baseline. But what else do you do? And it's person to person. I think that the people are interested in people. And I think too often we forget that. Just apply data to ultimately human individuals. And I think it's, especially recently, it's important to remember that we are best connected person to person.
Yeah, completely agree. I was wrapped in that there, to be fair, because there's so many different directions I can go with that when my mind's going at the moment. But the first of those is that this traditional path that we go on and this traditional linear progression and success is exactly as you've outlined, particularly from people from the particular backgrounds that we were maybe speaking from, Fergus, where you go to a relatively good school, you get the hires, GCSEs or A-levels that you need to go to the best possible university you can get, where you can get the best possible piece of paper that opens the door to the best possible grad scheme. And then you go from there.
And then you're dead.
Yeah.
that's the way it goes. It's working for retirement rather than being present. And that's what, I mean, I've learned it through a negative experience, but it's, I realized it wasn't for me. And I'm now taking the steps to sort of find, well, to break the cycle of always looking to the future and trying to enjoy the here and now a little bit more.
Yeah, and I think that's very healthy. And I was laughing when you're saying about a theology degree, mine's a politics degree. The majority of my corporate career, and for 7 years I've worked in insurance, and I'm now working in student accommodation and furniture. So it's nothing to do with the fact that I was particularly well read on Marx and Aristotle.
Yeah.
It's more to do with the fact that my people skills when I was at university, my presenting, my ability to take large amounts of information and put it into a succinct argument.
Yeah.
And some of that's translated over into the social stuff that I do as well. But it's really funny how I think I can see some parallels with yourself, and obviously you had a much more negative experience at university than I did, but or as elements of it anyway. But I just found university was a means to an end. I just needed that bit of paper from a Russell Group institution to get into certain jobs. That was all I was thinking, which is, I don't think that's the way we should look at education.
Why spend 3 years of your life and 27 grand if you weren't from Scotland or went to a Scottish university to just coast 3 years for a piece of paper? It just doesn't make sense to me. I think it's time wasted. That's 3 years that could have been better spent. And for years, I mean, I've always been torn, and there's some people that finish Russell Group universities that turn their noses up at people that haven't gone to university. But my entire 3 years at university, I thought, Christ, I wish I'd done a vocational degree or done an apprenticeship or something, because I'd actually be progressing. I'd actually be moving forwards in my life now, rather than just sitting here for 3 years watching people get drunk around me, getting drunk myself, and actually not really going anywhere. I was still training. I was training for powerlifting at the time, but my academic progress was purely box ticking. It wasn't actual meaningful development as an individual. And the questions that I asked were all negative. Why am I doing this? How is this helping me? And then after a while, you can only go through that for so long before the means to an end becomes, you don't see the ends to justify the means anymore. And when you hit that, what are you doing? And that was the question that I was faced with, I mean, from almost 3 weeks into university.
That's quick, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you sobered up after Freshers Week, and then you're like, right, okay, what's going on here?
Even Freshers Week, I just didn't feel like I was in the right place. I wasn't around the right people. And the way the system was at Durham with the collegiate system, you basically had a university within a university, which I didn't realise.
Which college were you at?
I was St Cuthbert's to start with, but okay. I was at the, for anyone that knows, I was at the second site that was down by the racecourse.
Stockton?
No, not that far away. But there's the Bailey Colleges in Durham, which are on the sort of the main old traditional high street, sort of right in the thick of it, which is where St Cuthbert's is. And then they've got a self-catering college down by the racecourse with the sports pitches. And I chose that because it was self-catering, not because of any of the attributes of the college itself.
Was this the fitness lifestyle that was...
Correct, yeah, correct. So, I mean, my 17, 18 at school, I used to have a little pair of Joseph expandable scales that I took with me to the school lunch hall because I was so focused on my fitness from that young an age. And I chose self-catering because I thought, I want to be in control of my food. Simple. Not realizing that the identities of the people around you, the personalities of the people around you, largely were dictated by the college that you're in. So very quickly, I felt like I wasn't around like-minded people, and I turned up to my course, and straight away I realized it was mostly philosophy, religion, rather than the historical sort of analytical side of things, which I more enjoyed. Didn't have a team sport because powerlifting, weightlifting wasn't a part of the university at all. Tried to start something and was told there was just no space, there was no facilities. There wasn't even a squat rack in the main university gym for the first 3 months that I was at Durham.
A university the size of Durham?
Yeah. Well, if you were in one of the sports teams, you had this wonderful S&C centre, but if you weren't, you had nothing.
Wild.
Straight away, I was like, right, well, this isn't what I expected. This isn't what I worked hard to get to. When all my mates at the universities that work less hard than me were having a great time, had made loads of friends, we're in a sports team, we're doing well, we're enjoying the course. And I was like, well, I've been sold a lie here.
Yeah.
And rather than doing anything about it, I then sat back and thought, is what it is. If you admit that you were wrong, then you'll look like a dickhead because this was what you were hell-bent on achieving. You've now achieved it. So to detract from that is admitting that you were wrong. Admitting that you're wrong is letting yourself down is being a failure. And then the spiral began, kind of.
Seeing that inability to step back and maybe drop out, for example, that would not fit with the narrative of I'm Fergus and I progress and I succeed. Correct. And the realms of success that you defined and that many of us defined at that stage in our lives and in society that we have just now would be get a first class degree within these 3 years or get a 2-1 within these 3 years, and don't dare take a step sideways. You don't want to tell mum and dad that you're wanting to drop out, or oh guys, I've picked the wrong course or whatever. They'd be like, no, like we've spent a lot, we're supported you through school and you've been supported to go to this university, you've taken this big loan, please don't, like, just give it a try, especially after 3 weeks, because at that point there was probably opportunity to turn it around if things had changed. Maybe, I don't know, move of college or some of that. I think you explored that.
I did move college in the end. Well, I mean, it's a separate story in itself, because I basically say I had no close friends for the first term at university. I then met somebody at the gym who I then kind of met up with outside of the gym and then became part of his friendship group. However, this was in December, and anyone that's been to university in the UK, you'll know you'll sign for the people that you live with for the next 2 years within about 15 seconds of knowing them. So they'd all already signed for a house in second year, so that dash of hope was taken away from me. And then I was faced with the decision, do I live on my own in private halls in Durham, or do I move to Newcastle and live with three mates from a school that I used to go to in Edinburgh? And I chose the latter based on the fact that I'd rather be around people rather than be pointed at as the guy living on his own in private halls, not in any of our houses, because I knew that would socially isolate me even more. But then the flip side of that was I was detaching myself even more from the university of which I was a student. And that wasn't a problem for a while, but then it started to manifest itself as I was asking the questions of why is a Durham student living in Newcastle and spending time with, and it just started to perpetuate it without any real justification, I'm sure.
Was it in your own head, or did anyone ever say to you, like, oh, why do you still live in Newcastle?
Yeah, I mean, it was a question, but it wasn't like ooh, freak. It wasn't like that.
But in your head it maybe was.
Yeah, I think so. I think so after a while, because I went into Durham 3 days a week, I had 9 hours of contact time, $27,000 a year. That was $27,000 across 3 years. It was money well spent, Christ. And I just felt more and more detached. I'd go in on the train in the morning, and it was Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday. I'd go to my lecture, go to my seminar. I'd then sit in a Starbucks, the same one every time, get the work that I needed to be done that day, go home, and I'd either train or I'd kind of try and box everything off in Durham itself. And then that'd be it. No interaction, nothing else. Because the timetables of the guys that I was friends with, they were all doing things together. They were at the library most of the day, but because I wasn't on their timetable, etc., I was always out of the loop. And then I gave up on trying to get in the loop after a while. And then, yeah, things started to... I mean, those 3 weeks that I first mentioned, from the off, I started to feel very lonely, very isolated. But the way that I was at the time, as we've said, I wasn't willing to take a step back. I wasn't willing to admit that actually I was in the wrong position. And that's where, retrospectively, it's been diagnosed that I started to suffer with depression. Retrospectively, because it was a long, long time before I actually had anyone give me a diagnosis, because I didn't tell anyone about the experience I was having. So October 2014 was when I started university. I'd say by November, I was suffering from depression. And then, I mean, first year was first year. I got through it. I did end up moving college in the exam term of first year, although in December I was told I'd be able to move college, but it didn't happen until the final term because of paperwork. Oh, it's very difficult to do all this, all that. And the second I said, well, actually, I think I'm suffering with mental health, it happened in 3 days. So,
and that was back then as well, I think we hopefully move forward since then too.
But I mean, even still, the guidance counsellor at the college doesn't need to be a genius to have been, like, the conversations we were having, I had to explicitly say that it was affecting me in that way for him to actually pull his finger out. Even though at that point, I in my head, I felt like I was saying it as a...
you were hinting at it.
As a way out. Like, I didn't... In my head, it wasn't... it wasn't a real thing. Like, in my head, I didn't actually want to say out loud I was suffering with my mental health, because I didn't believe that I was. But I felt if I said that, that might get me to move college, which I think is what I need to do. So I said it and it happened. But the fact it turned around so quickly when I said that was just insulting. upon reflection. So I moved college, but then everyone was in exams. So it was kind of pointless anyway, because everybody was on their own timetables. Everyone was very hardworking, and I wasn't actually spending time with the people that I moved college to be with. And I went from self-catering to not self-catering. And it was kind of just not out of the frying pan into the fire, but it wasn't the change that I hoped it would be. Summer holidays of that year, I can't actually really remember what I did, to be honest. And I'll probably take that as a good thing, as it wasn't an overly negative nor an overly positive experience, but I was just in this haze of early phase depression, I guess. Started second year, enjoyed being in Newcastle for quite a while. I could go out with people, I could spend time with people. Food and drink scene in Newcastle is incredible. Bigger city to be a part of, grew up in Edinburgh, always liked the city. Was living in Jesmond, which is a beautiful part of Newcastle, and yeah, just enjoyed it for a bit, and then was going to a proper gym. I was traveling 30 minutes on the metro and 15 minute walk each direction each day, so it was a big part of my day. And one of my flatmates started coming with me, so I actually had somebody to do something with, and just got on with my work for a while. And then we sort of hit the second half of that year, and then everybody's work ramped up, everybody's timetable changed, and all of a sudden I was sort of spending a lot more time on my own. Everybody's timetable meant that we weren't doing things together really, and when we were doing things together, or people were doing things in little satellite groups that I was bolted onto. So I'd get more and more uncomfortable explaining who I was and why I was there, because I felt uncomfortable with it personally. Yeah. Whether they were reading into it the same way as I was, probably not. But at that point, I was in enough of a depressive state that it started to manifest itself negatively. And I should say at this point, I had not confronted this with anyone in terms of opening about it. And I had not, until depression started to affect me physically in sort of exam season of 2016, when I couldn't sleep properly, I could barely eat. I was getting split in half by 100 kilos, warming up my squats, just furious.
Which, based on previous performances,
yeah, I was squatting 230 at the time. Yeah. So it was just, it didn't make any sense. And when it started to affect me physically, it was the first time in my life that I'd acknowledged that depression and mental health was actually a thing. Because up until that point, I'd been very, very in the mindset that it was an excuse for weak-minded people, a way of people avoiding responsibility, because I was stuck in this perpetual, I don't want to use the phrase toxic masculinity, because I think it's very, very confused in terms of how it's portrayed in the media, but my perception of masculinity was toxic.
Did you say like maybe more rugby lad culture? Like I played rugby when I was younger as well, and it was a bit like that.
It was more the person that I wanted to be. The person I wanted to be was this infallible, wealthy, successful man. And that meant that all my edges had to be hard. I couldn't give anything away. I couldn't reveal any weakness, all this stuff. So this is what I'm referring to before. Everything I was doing was based on my perception and my ambitions for my future rather than what I was doing in the here and now. So every little step that I deviated from the plan meant that I felt like a failure, because it wasn't putting me closer to these lofty goals that I had for myself that had been sort of fed to me from a young age of this is how you become successful. I mean, Edinburgh's very white collar. What I like about Glasgow, what I like about Liverpool and other cities is you meet people and they're not all senior partners at EY, they're not all MDs at Deloitte. You hear people that have got these stories to tell of how they've become successful, enjoy what they're doing. But growing up in a white collar city, I think made me very, very, the only world that I knew was the white collar linear progression one. And I think from a young age, my first school, I did fuck all work. And I was on the verge of being expelled because I was so disruptive.
I heard you say this before, and it's so strange when you look at who you are now, but that's again.
That's what's crazy is I was almost expelled. I was basically told leave or be expelled. I got in with a crowd. I was impressionable. I got in with a bad crowd, and basically some people tried to pin some stuff on me that wasn't me at all. And then because I was kind of the fall guy, all the parents bought into it, it became a mess. And it was horrible for my parents, but I can't deny that I was a dickhead of a child. I wasn't working hard. I was wasting my parents' time, money, effort, support. Moved to school with smaller class sizes and the more integrated rugby environment, more sort of a hard working environment where you can't just coast and get away with things, more of a caring and actually deliberated environment. And actually I then learnt how to learn, I'd say, ahead of my GCSEs. And then went from a kid that was probably not due to get any GCSEs and had no future at all. I was told that by teachers at the previous school, to I think I got eight A's, three A stars. So I was buzzing with that, like absolutely.
Yeah, like top yeah. performance online to go to a Russell Group institution, which was success.
Yeah, exactly. And then I learned how to learn. I got a taste of actually the gratification that came from doing some work, seeing the results, and actually shocking myself at the results that I did get. Because I thought, actually, hang on, if you do, it became 1 + 1 = 2 to me. And then we went into lower sixth, and I was doing 4A levels, and this is the point where I had 3 concussions in 4 weeks playing rugby, which meant that I was told in no uncertain terms, no more contact sport for a while. That was a huge part of my life that was sort of put on the back burner. It didn't hit me too hard at the time because I still trained as if I was a rugby player. I still had all my mates. My sense of community was gone in terms of the Tuesdays, Thursdays and Saturdays. But I'd learned to fill that time by just pursuing health and fitness, learning about health and fitness, you know, the bodybuilding.com forums, et cetera, at the time. So much so that I actually asked my parents, can I borrow some money to do a personal training qualification to further my education? Not knowing how little education actually comes with a level 3 personal training qualification in the UK. But I got through that just from a place of passion. I went from 105 kilos at 15 years old to 76. I went all the way down, was running 37 minute 10Ks as well as weightlifting more frequently throughout the week than I should have been doing. Basically the exact opposite of what I propose to people now. But just fell in love with the versatility of self-improvement and these metrics that came from running, lifting, calories, tracking, weights on the scale, progress, how I looked in the mirror, all this stuff. I became obsessed with it to the point where I started helping the first 15 with their S&C because I just absorbed information at this age, absorbed information. And as I said, I was very meticulous about calorie tracking. I was very meticulous about my programming from a very young age and then fell into powerlifting with Andy Smith because we met at Virgin in Fountain Park and he sort of brought me over to powerlifting from a more consistent point of view because I'd done one competition with GBPF, didn't enjoy it at all, no music, everybody thought they were like Arnold Schwarzenegger in terms of I didn't like the environment at all. I still don't like the environment of those competitions. And then Andy sort of brought me over to a different federation just for the sake of enjoyment, used deadlift bars, used wraps, really enjoyed it. And then thought, yeah, I'll do this for a few years. But the key thing was once I'd learned how to learn and sort of got that taste of success, the fitness then became one of the pillars of control that allowed me to really accelerate that success. So once we got to lower six, upper six, like even now upon reflection, I don't think there is any way that I possibly could have worked harder in my lower six. I was the absolute optimal version way before morning routines were cool, way before all this stuff was cool. I was so ahead of the curve at 17, which is mad to me thinking back now because it all happened by accident. It didn't come from a self-help book. It just seemed logical.
Probably weren't listening to like podcasts or anything like that to direct you.
Max Tuning, Guzman, forums, and just that was it. Like, but the school environment was so structured that I could put my structures around that structure, which was control, 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 control. And then once I'd seen the delayed gratification from the hard work of the 2 years, having been basically a waste of space for 4 years, I then just went absolutely all in for my AS levels and actually averaged 96% across the board in my 4 exams.
Incredible.
Got full marks in my English AS level, just purely by graph. Like this is the thing, I retain information well, but I say again, I could not possibly work harder. I remember the Easter holidays, for example, the Easter holidays of before exams, I remember I was sitting at the front desk in the house in Edinburgh, and it was 4 weeks Easter, I had a day-to-day plan from every single day of the Easter holidays before the Easter holidays started at that front desk. Day one of the Easter holidays, I sat down, and I didn't deviate by a minute the entire Easter holidays. 17 years old.
You respond really well to structure, you can see that.
Yeah, which is crazy. But I was doing 9-hour days at my desk, 7 days a week over the Easter holidays. That was it. And I was 17, mate. Like, I don't know how I gave so much of a shit about this, but I just got a taste of
purpose.
I think it was just turning around and feeling that sense of purpose, but also feeling like I could not prove people wrong, but feeling like actually I was wrong in the sense that I felt like I was useless. So I kind of wanted to prove myself right, but also maybe a bit of an element of make up to my parents. And those results got me into the mix for Oxbridge. And then the school saw me as a statistic, obviously, as a potential statistic. So I went all in on trying to study English literature at Oxford. So started tailoring all my coursework around that, started doing loads of external reading on what could prepare me best for an interview. I went down and spoke with people that were sort of mutual friends to try and get ways around talking to them on this, talking to them on that. And mate, like I was locked in. It wasn't something that I felt I should be doing. It's something that I felt like I wanted to be doing. I was completely like, it was my entire existence at such a young age. And you can probably see where this is going, because this is quite a stressful existence. And then didn't get an interview at Oxford because I think reading between the lines that transpired, I probably should have applied to Cambridge because they put more emphasis on your AS results rather than your GCSEs, whereas Oxford, I mean, all these little bullshitty games you play for this linear progressive load of shite really is all it is. Yeah. But it's just, I was locked in. That first knock being my dad turning up at the door saying, you haven't got in, was a real punch in the gut. But I'd got to Durham, which was prestigious. I'd worked hard for it. And now I could coast for that sort of final year at university because I needed like 50% of my exams to get what I needed. So I kind of scaled things back a little bit there, was very focused on fitness still, but I started drinking again. I started socializing a bit more. I started eating Nutella. I started I went from being orthorexic, I'd say, whereby completely focused on eating the same things at the same time every day, even though I was still like, I'd weigh a tin of tuna and weigh my mayo, even though it'd be the same thing that I'd eat the same time every day, I'd still have to weigh it. But if it wasn't light mayo, I couldn't have it. If it wasn't the sweet corn that I put in my fitness bar before, the very, very specific orthorexic.
I can sympathize entirely. I've had periods like that with my fitness bar. It happens, especially with personality types that.
You slip into it real easily. So then I went to university. I know we've got a massive little scale back here, but went to university.
I've enjoyed it. Don't worry about it. I'm sure the listeners have too.
That was the framework that I went into university with, which gives a bit more context as to why I was so disappointed when I turned up and it was just coasting, no academic.
Nine hours of class time though. Going from what you had.
I went from 9 hours of work a day minimum, plus everything else to 9 hours a week. And with no reason, no incentives to push hard. You needed 40%. There was no, if you get 60%, you can do this class, you can accelerate here. There was none of that. 40% doesn't matter what you do. And I was like, well, and the first few essays I did, I got 65, 67. I thought, well, that was doing fuck all work. How little can I get away with here? And then I started thinking, well, you don't want to do a little. And I was doing extra work on Saturday nights and stuff because that was just what I was used to doing. And then when I stopped doing that, I started feeling like a failure because I'd gone backwards. And then, as I said, all the stuff I mentioned before fell in. And then when I started to be affected by depression physically about 18 months later, that's when it became overwhelmingly real. And I say this all the time. Anyone that's listened to podcasts with me before will have heard this critical turning point, which is that a week went past Sunday to Sunday where I hadn't said a word out loud to anyone other than a cashier, barista, something like that. And when I realized that, I just felt so overwhelmingly isolated and alone. I remember pacing up and down my room, just wanting to call my mum, but trying to think of a reason to call her to talk about something without just sort of picking up the phone and having somebody on the other end. But then I didn't do it because I thought that she might figure out that something's wrong. And the exact timelines from that point, I'm not sure, but early May of 2016, it got to the point where that I decided to attempt to take my own life. And swallowed as many pills as I could get my hands on from as many sources as I could, drank what I think was about a litre of spirit, and hoped not to wake up. But what I sort of introspectively determined recently is that it was actually when I was talking to Roman Kemp off camera, was he asked me about the decision-making progress at the time. And what I realised is that I'd never consciously thought, I want to die. I just consciously thought, I want some peace. And it was a form of procrastination almost, in the sense that I wanted peace. How to do that? Shut everything off. What does that mean? Go unconscious. I didn't think you aren't going to wake. I didn't want to wake up, but in my head that didn't mean you are going to die, because if I admitted that I was going to die, I'd then have to confront what I'd leave behind. And that's what challenges me now. I mean, I'm obviously very comfortable talking about all this, but what I still struggle to process sometimes is that all the things that I've done, the things I've achieved, the people I've met, conversations like these, everything that's happened since then almost wasn't a part of human existence.
Yeah, wasn't a consideration for what might come.
Exactly, yeah. But it's just, I feel so fortunate and so lucky to be where I am now that it's mind-boggling to me that I was ever in the position that I felt that I had no way out, but I know how I got there, and it was because of this perpetual resilience to change, I guess. I had my control metrics, I had my structures, I had all this, and I'd set a plan. That's what I'm meant to do. My biggest error was not being able to make the plan more malleable and rolling with the punches, as it were. Not even rolling with the punches. I wasn't, I was dealt a bad hand at university, but it wasn't like my parents died. It was something that I could adapt to, but I refused to adapt to it because it wasn't part of the plan.
Yep.
And that was the mistake that I made. And whether that was down to the edge, I mean, I went to an excellent school. And I'm very fortunate that I did. But it was almost, without having gone straight into the military or straight into a white-collar corporate existence where I was being worked to the bone day in, day out, there was nowhere that I could have gone from that environment that would have satisfied me as an individual.
Because that was what was ticking your boxes at school. Like, on those last final years at school, you were stimulated by intense structure, intense metrics that you could work towards. Calories, grades, weights, whatever else.
Yeah, yeah. And it was all metric based. It was too black and white because my metrics for success were tied up in the metrics of my day-to-day existence. And the way I look at success now is very different in the sense it's how much time can I spend with the people that I like spending time with doing the things that I enjoy. And if I can spend more time doing that, then I'm more successful than the bloke that earns 250 grand but never gets to see his kids, in my mind. Whereas the old version of me would have thought, any time spent not chasing all these goals is time wasted. So it's just, it's a fascinating, I mean, I think it's, I from what I've gathered from speaking to people, I think it's a realization that everybody comes to at some point in their life. I'm just fortunate enough that I came to it at 23. And I've sort of gone through, it was when I was in London, we'll get to it, I'm sure, but it was when I was about 18 months, 2 years into my professional career out of university, I sort of realized I'd claimed back the time that I felt I'd lost to my depression, and then I actually started to reflect on who I was as an individual at a more primal level, like who am I really? And that's when I sort of started to realize that there's more to life than I previously thought, and the more that I can do now using those new metrics for success, the more I can endure my existence. And I've been focusing on those metrics for the past 3 years now, more than I had been previously, and I'm much happier for it.
Happier, but also having a considerably more positive impact, because you were probably positive to be around back then, largely.
Yeah, but which was another thing. I didn't want to let down that responsibility.
Yeah.
I had become the reliable one in the group. I had become the pillar of strength, so therefore, don't lose that crown. And if you admit that you're struggling, you'll take the Burger King hat off. You'll have to give it to someone else.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, which I don't know whether it wasn't an ego thing. It was more a pride thing. Like, I was really proud of this turnaround that I'd made. I manufactured for myself, and I never felt better than anyone for doing it. None of that. I don't in any way now. I'm very not driven by ego. I mean, there's an old version of me from an aesthetic, vain point of view that probably was a little bit.
Yeah, Z's inspired and whatnot.
Yeah, obviously. And just the amount of hair gel I'm still got through on a day-to-day basis. I used to straighten my hair as well. Just, I wouldn't leave the house without straightening my hair. But the vanity was the ego thing, but the actual self-development side of things was a responsibility and a pride thing, because I knew that at one point I was written off as just this little dickhead, this little overweight, just non-hardworking, useless, waste of space. And I was proud of the turnaround that I'd found for myself. To let go of that within my social circles would have been that fear of going backwards.
Loss of identity as well.
Yeah, 100%.
How do you move forward from a suicide attempt like that? And like you say, you've reflected now and you were wanting peace. You didn't obviously get peace. How do you move forward?
So, came around in a puddle of my own vomit, furious because I had taken one single initiative in the past 2 years to mitigate my depression, and it had not worked. So at that point, I felt more of a failure than I ever had done up until that point. Then slowly started to realize, as I became more conscious, I mean, at this point, I was still absolutely ruined. Like, physically wasn't working, couldn't move my fingers, could barely move my eyes, but I was conscious but unable to move because of the drugs and the booze. And when I actually started to become a bit more cognitive, I realized that this was a very desperate situation to be in, to the point where, I mean, I was obviously in shock, but I was kind of cruising on adrenaline, I think, at that point, whereby there was enough of a shock that it gave me a bit of peace from the white noise inside my head to think something needs to change, which was the first time I'd acknowledged this has got to the point where you can't keep going. Because look where it's got you, and even that's not worked. What I would like to say that I did was at that point I phoned my friends, phoned my family, and told them about what had happened, but I didn't because I was still ashamed of the fact that that might be the case. But I think it was 2 or 3 days, and then I was slowly coming back to it. I went to the gym, I went to university as if nothing had happened, all the usual stuff, and just tried to pretend it hadn't happened, really. Completely brush it under the carpet. And then I got a message from Andy, who's been on the podcast, saying, I'm getting a puppy from this litter next week. You in? Fully taking the piss. And I thought, in the back of my mind, the second he said that, I thought, yes, that is exactly what I need, because it gives me, well, what I honestly could talk about structure, responsibility, control, all the things it gave me, but that only came retrospectively. I think the first thing that I jumped out at when he said it was a heartbeat. And it was something else.
Companionship.
Just companionship. That was all that I wanted. And I think my brain just defaulted to, you need that. And then once I had a 14-week-old French Bulldog puppy on a student loan 2 weeks later, obviously, this isn't something I recommend as a solution, by the way, but the point will shine through. But the overnight, I went from having no structure, no routine, no purpose to having all three of those things. I had a reason to get out of bed in the morning. I had a reason to get outside. I had a reason to walk. I had a reason to be alone with my own thoughts. I had something to laugh at, something to smile with, etc., etc. And then what started to happen is, if you're walking around Newcastle with a 14-week-old French Bulldog puppy, people are going to talk to you. It's a very friendly part of the world, and I love Newcastle, still do. But it wasn't like, oh, how are you doing? How are you doing? Oh, yeah, no, I've had a really tough time recently. It was just, oh, how old is he? What's he like? Is he toilet trained? But the key difference was I was talking to people. I didn't feel alone. I didn't feel isolated again. And before I knew it, that momentum built. And then I was sitting in coffee shops working rather than sitting in bed working. And then I made friends with the people in the coffee shop. And then there was a family that lived across the road that came in at the same time every day. And then we chatted every day. And then they decided in the mornings when I was working, they'd take Odie on a walk and bring him back. So I had uninterrupted work for university. I was working for university again, big tick. Whereas I'd started with Odie in my lap, hunched over, like writing with a pen and using my laptop, trying to keep him on my lap because I knew he wouldn't piss on the floor if he was on my lap.
He's 14 weeks old.
Exactly. But I knew he'd be more comfortable asleep on me than he would be finding somewhere to go for a piss in the coffee shop.
Just now, Fergus, your smile that you've got reminiscing about that is incredible, but also... Look at the sharp contrast between this Sunday to Sunday period that led to your most challenging, darkest moment, where you weren't speaking to anybody apart from maybe saying thank you or ordering a hot coffee.
Yeah. But the thing that got me there was not, yes, OD was the catalyst, but what got me there was the momentum from having conversations with people again. And that's the key point. So don't, especially not in today's climate, given the cost of them, but a 14-week-old French Bulldog is not my oracle solution to depression. My experience was Odie was the catalyst that allowed me to talk to people again. Talking to people again allowed me to actually feel more comfortable being outside, feel a bit more comfortable about that. And then I was on a steady state of improvement. Summer holidays, I was working in a bar in Edinburgh. I was back with friends. I knew loads of people in Edinburgh, and I could sort of spend a different night of the week with different friends. And I was very, very happy just being happy again, I guess. I was drinking more consistently than I should, still training frequently, but I was 20, how old was I, 20? Yeah, 20, and just enjoying being that age in Edinburgh, being happy again. And then Christmas 2016, my mum never wanted a dog. We'd asked for a dog for years and it never happened. And then here I was at the family house for Christmas with said dog. So the conversation came up being like, you've pulled the wool over her eyes, you've just gone behind her back here. We're like, what's all this about? Mum wasn't pleased about it. And then at that point, I thought, you know what? Actually, I need to explain why he's here, because there's, aside from the symbolism.
It's an elephant in the room.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. And but if I didn't explain it, it would be a problem and it would make the relationship a bit tenuous, because it would, the way she'd seen it is I'd just gone behind her back and done something she explicitly said she didn't want in her home. Like, yes, I was visiting, but it was their house. So explained it to them, and actually getting that off my chest was a very liberating experience, and actually at that point allowed me to start to move forwards rather than just coasting again, I think. finished my final year at university. I was living with the guys that I mentioned from first year and third year, which was great, in the city centre of Durham. Had Odie with me. I enjoyed my third year immensely, and I'm very thankful to those guys for being a part of it. And got a 2-1 from Durham in theology and religion. Happy days. Graduated on Friday in July, Friday the 4th, and on the 7th started Heineken UK's Fast Track Graduate Scheme, so a 2-day summer holiday. Not the final summer holiday I thought it would be, but went down for, started on the Monday with Heineken's Fast Track Grad Scheme, which was 3 months all intensive. We assess you, see what you can do, and then we might give you a job at the end. So it's pretty intense. It's like the most intense grad scheme they offer. Got to the end of 3 months, was offered a position full-time. So went out of a grad scheme that was 3 months long into a full-time regional sales manager position as part of the London team in October-ish, give or take.
Yep.
And free beer in London is financially useful. It's fun because it meant that I still navigate London by pubs. If somebody says, oh, I live here, I'll say, okay, well, what's the nearest pub? And I'll go, oh, yeah, I know you are. But it was a good, being in London, being in the thick of it, being in the intensity, being with friends from uni, being some friends from school, new experiences, all this stuff was great. It was great. But I was traveling an hour each direction to get my training done at Genesis Gym in Alperton. So I was traveling from Southwest London to Genesis. So I was getting to bed at midnight. I was staying at a friend's house who didn't have any kitchen utensils, but I was staying there for like 6 to 8 weeks. So I thought, I'm not going to buy all my kitchen utensils for a property that I'm not going to be in permanently and leave for him, but I am equally not going to need to take them with me. So I was kind of like eating out of meal deals and stuff for a while. I was prepping for the final competition in powerlifting that I ended up doing. Not final, but the most recent, I guess. And I say again, it was a new experience which had an expiry date upon reflection. I was enjoying it for a while, but I was a bit of a weekend warrior. And then, mate, Fridays I'd have one sip of beer and just lose the plot.
It'd be the catalyst.
Yeah, quite simply, that'd be it. But it's a fun place to be. Like, I don't want to demonize it in many ways. It depends. Your relationship with that city, with cities in general, in that sort of job is what matters, because you can interact with it in a healthy way, or you can drown your sorrows by not being fulfilled from the day job, by blacking out the weekends.
Yeah, escapism.
Yeah, yeah. And I didn't feel like it was that, but booze was a big part of the job. Like, it was the job. And my dad had grown up in the booze industry. He was managing director at Caledonian Brewery for 20 years in Edinburgh. So I'd always seen the sort of the sports tickets, the coming home from events at the pub where you meet some really interesting, fascinating people, and I really enjoyed that. But at the same time, I was competing in powerlifting. I was still tracking my calories. I was about 100 kilos, but I was a strength athlete, and I was still conscious of what I was eating. It just wasn't necessarily the highest food quality. But the pints were all factored for, and I was at this constant battle with, you work in the booze industry, but you do this. This is a bit weird. And then it started to feel like my training was falling by the wayside because it was such a long way to get there. I did a powerlifting competition in 2017. Finished it and thought,
all right. Not stimulated by
anything. Yeah, wasn't. It, I don't know. Even if I'd pulled a bigger deadlift on the day, would I have been a bit happier? Probably not. I think I just it didn't feel worth it anymore. It didn't feel like it was adding the value to my life that it was maybe taken away. And then I got caught in a policy change at Heineken, which basically meant that my KPIs were based on installing premium products in wholesale. In wholesale accounts. However, the wholesalers that I looked after had to be signed on to a certain agreement with dispense equipment, so a certain standard of beer dispensing equipment,
yep,
for those premium products to be sold. None of my wholesalers were signed on for the premium dispense solutions, so I couldn't sell them what I was being tasked on from, yep, a KPI. This, yep, went on for 3 months. I brought it up every week to my boss. He brought it up to his boss. But the big green machine that is a company of that size.
Yeah, there's a lot of red tape, Fergus, and we'll get to that.
But it was, I went from enjoying it to, I could have done three days out of five doing fuck all. Like, I could have got away with it, which some people might have loved, but I just felt,
well, you would have lost your purpose, and we've just seen what that means to you.
Exactly. And then one day I was sitting in Brixton Hill, the coffee shop just around the corner. I had a decent routine where I was there at 8 every morning, flat white and a salted caramel brownie. Not good financial habits, but I had a good time. And one morning I opened my laptop up and I just got slammed with this white noise, like slammed with it, to the point where I almost, I almost felt like I was hot, claustrophobic, felt like I was about to, I was fighting back tears in this coffee shop, just like, what the fuck was that? Closed the laptop, and then just thought, you've been here before, what did you do last time? You approached it in the wrong way. What were you missing? Sense of fulfillment. Okay. What else were you missing? You were missing that conversation and actually confronting this and tackling it head on. Okay. So what do you need? You need a sense of purpose, you need a sense of fulfillment, you need to tackle this head on. So I thought, right, what's meaningful? What can I do? Some sort of charity project sounds like something I can work on. Andy was just about to open Lyft. I thought maybe I can do something to help out with the PR side of things.
Promotion,
there.
Yeah.
What are you good at? You're good at squatting. I think at that time I just squatted 260 in competition and I squatted 272.5 for a high. It was high. A high rep in the gym, but still, £600. And I thought, okay, squatting. There's something there. And then thought, right, charity. I'll do something for cancer research. That's like a thing that people do. And then I thought, well, I don't really have any personal attachment to this. What about Movember? I've seen some stuff with them from rugby. I've grown a moustache last year. It's always been a part of rugby. It kind of like skyrocketed in early 2010s and then dipped for a bit and then came back with a vengeance. And I thought, right, I'll look it up. And then I quickly found out they've got cult status. They've got all these partnerships with these brands. They've got these amazing ambassadors and they've got the Distinguished Gentleman's Ride, which is just cool. But in my mind, it wasn't just cool, but it also disguised a little bit the fact that I was going to be talking about sensitive male issues.
Yeah.
So
in a more macho package.
Exactly. The cult status of it almost deviated a little bit from the actual intentions. But when I then basically started looking at projects I could do related to squatting with Movember, saw that 500,000 men take their own lives every year around the world globally. That's a statistic that Movember uses as part of their marketing campaigns. I thought, right, obviously, you're going to try and squat 500,000 kilos in 24 hours. Logic takes you there, as it does. But phoned Movember, told them this is what I want to do. They're like, okay, you're an idiot. They didn't say that. That's what I said to myself in the mirror most days. But it was they were completely on board, very supportive, came on board. And then I thought, right, okay, I'll put this out there, see what sticks. Just put out a Microsoft Paint little graphic from a photo of a powerlifting competition saying this is what I'm doing. Got a few freebies from brands here or there saying this is what I'm doing. Got everything set up to go at Lyft. Got a coach on board. He's now a business partner. And just put it out there on my Facebook saying, I am doing this for men's mental health and suicide prevention. That was all I said. And people were so on board with it, so supportive, so much positive feedback that after 2 weeks, I actually got enough confidence to just say, you know what? I'm going to actually provide, I'm now aware of the real reason why I'm doing this. And just shared publicly in 2016, I attempted suicide after 2 years of sustained depression. And all the people that knew me throughout those periods were shocked.
Yeah.
All the periods that knew me since were utterly shocked, and it then brought a lot of people out of the woodwork that were very happy to share similar experiences that they'd had or been having that were in my immediate social circles.
You generate conversation, Fergus, which is now what you want to do on a daily basis.
Well, that's it. But I say again, happened by accident, from a place of passion. So that project was amazing. I ended up leaving Heineken in October to see it through to December. Squatted in front of 12,500 people at Twickenham Stoop with Harlequins, spoke at some global PLCs. It was just, it was a complete whirlwind, but I just went all in, completely making it up as I go along. Like, no idea what I was doing, really, just thinking, say yes to every opportunity, anything that sounds like it could be useful, do it. Any conversation you can have, have it. Any podcast you can go on, jump on it, all this stuff. And long story short, raised 25 grand in year one. Sadly, tore my MCL and sprained my patella tendon at about 3 in the morning and about 127,000 kilos worth and about 5 hours deep. So,
God.
Would not recommend. Yeah, that was a tough day. But lying on the floor, crying my eyes out, and I thought, you know what? Your mind's outlasted your body. That's quite hard to do. Well done. But also, all these messages were flooding in from people that were up on a school night. It was a Wednesday because I did it on my 23rd birthday. 23rd birthday. There were people up at 3 in the morning. Joe Marler was up at 3 in the morning watching it.
Engaged
just,
with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, just sent me a message just saying, oh, so sorry to see this, but like at the end of the day, who gives a shit? It was all about the process rather than...
Just about to say that. It didn't matter whether you did the...
I needed reminded at that point though, because there was still that inkling of old Fergus saying the end.
Well, that was the metric, wasn't it? That was the success.
Yeah. But the metric then became the impact. And at that point, that gave me the... That the easy thing to do at that point, lying on the floor, feeling like a failure, quote unquote, would have been to think, well, you tried, you've raised 25 grand, back to the shadows. But all these messages that I got were so encouraging and so seemingly meaningful that it gave me the confidence, actually, this is the thing that you do now. Then January 2019, started work for my dad, who now has a brewery in Liverpool, just same role, just as a sort of key account manager there. So slight uptake in responsibility relative to the previous Heineken job, but obviously in a much smaller pond, as part of a family business, which meant delivering kegs and all the non-glamorous stuff that goes with
it. Yeah, but equally, your customers could take the solution that you had to offer, whether it's the last 3 months at Heineken, you'd lost that.
But the customers were scousers. No, I'm kidding. It was a very fun place to work, but I did get a few phone calls at 10:30 p.m. Where's my delivery? It's due tomorrow. Be like, well, I wanted it tonight. Well, you didn't tell anyone. You didn't tell anyone that we wouldn't be able to do it anyway. But anyway, that's pointless. That pointless information. And then February 2019, started thinking on my next Movember project, and thought, okay, you can't go bigger than year one. You can go broader. So I thought I'll do 3 events in November, one on the first, one in the middle, and one at the end.
Yeah.
And had enjoyed using the statistics as the focal point for the challenge itself, because it means that you can't engage with the physical side of things without confronting the statistics. And a lot of people in strength sports and fitness environments think that they're mad hardcore because they lift weights 5 times a week. And therefore, they're above mental health, and that they're mad resilient.
You always see like 300 memes and stuff like that, like going to war with a squat rack, and you're like, honestly, mate, like you track your calories, and you're going to go and pose in your pants on a stage, like you're not going to war.
Hardest work in the room, all this stuff, and it's like, well, anyone that wants to engage with the physical stuff can't avoid the mental stuff, even if they don't necessarily want to. So that was logic, in that if I can draw people in from a physical point of view with the statistics, then it means that they won't be able to ignore it. So on the first, I bodyweight lunged 6,890 meters to represent the UK and Republic of Ireland suicide rate, male and female, in 2018. I think that took me 4 and a bit hours. And as far as I'm aware, that's the furthest anyone has ever bodyweight lunged in history.
Yeah, I was going to say, what a quad pump that would have been.
It's a very niche sport I've carved for myself here. And it was the quad pump to end all quad pumps, to be fair. But also, I'd had my final trial run, training run, the week before that, because it was the only way it fit in with training for the ultra that I did at the end of the month from Glasgow to Edinburgh. So the week before I did 6,890 lunges, I had ran 54 miles from Glasgow to Edinburgh overnight. I'll get to that, but my legs were fatigued going into it. So the pace that I'd been doing in training was tanked as a result of the fatigue from the run, but I had to balance these things. And on the 17th, I organized a 13-hour workout with 30 men at WIT in London. So that was anyone from Ollie Marchand to Faisal, PMA Fitness, to Tom Kemp, who'd just been on the cover of Men's Health at the time. So it was a real good bunch of guys all in the fitness space down there coming together for this cause. Huge reach of the room. I think the reach of the room was about 2.5 million, and we raised almost 20 grand of the day.
Right.
Final piece of the puzzle was 29th to 30th of November was Loch Lomond. So basically the Royal Denon car park at Loch Lomond for Ben Lomond, to BT Murrayfield. So a 94-mile run.
You were going to run that, okay.
Yeah, 94-mile run to represent the 94 male suicides a week in respect to the 2018 statistics. And that took me 22 hours and 15 minutes. And at the end of that, I'd organised a event at Murrayfield with all the local charities, Edinburgh Rugby, some Scottish Rugby players, all the local Edinburgh charities, Movember, Scott and Jenny Hastings spoke. We had a real range of people just sharing their stories, giving their insights. So a 2-hour event that about 140 people signed up for tickets for and came along. And then me arriving was sort of the kickoff for that event. So again, 150 people under one roof in Edinburgh just by putting some stuff out on social media and thinking, fuck it, let's give it a go. Yeah. All happening, just flying by the seat of my pants, seeing what's happening. And that's what happened. So came in, very emotional, 22 hours and 15 minutes later. 15 minutes later was... dick.
Is that the PR previously, 2 hours?
Well, no, it was just all the calculations. It was based on like structure again, but I was due to be coming into Murrayfield at 10 a.m. having started at 12 from Ben Lomond the day before. But that was that's where the ultra running stuff really started to develop, and the ultra endurance stuff really started to develop. But that year, I think, I can't even remember what it is. What was it? It was about, I think it was 32.5 grand. So again, 7.5 grand more than the year before, put my total above 50. 2 years of just making this up as I go along, just sort of taking favors, asking questions, phoning people, all this stuff. Then left the brewery to start to basically go it alone from a coaching and a Modern Mind point of view in January 2020. 2 weeks after I'd moved back up to Edinburgh with a view to starting properly in February, I got a job offer for Vigo Barefoot down in London.
Okay.
So I was going to stay in Edinburgh, commute Monday, Thursday, and sorry, commute from Edinburgh to London Monday, back Thursday, stay with a friend in Wandsworth and just keep doing what I was doing. So I was going to be a willy, as it's better known. Worked in London, lived in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
And started that on March 3rd. It was February. February the 3rd, yeah.
Just a month before coronavirus.
Yeah, month and a half. So I got literally two full months before I came back up from Wandsworth and didn't come back down. I never have been back down. I've still got a suitcase there. I need to sort that. I'll make a mental note of that one. But really enjoyed that. I was the health and wellbeing lead, which sounds like an HR job, but it was actually part of the marketing department, sort of implementing the health and wellbeing elements of the brand into the DNA of the marketing. But then there were elements of events, elements of interaction, elements of community stuff that were a part of the role that then obviously changed as everything happened with Corona. But alongside that, I was keeping my training up. When I was moving, I was training for the Keltman and for a powerlifting competition, and just sort of a no charity challenge, but just from a I probably should mention I did my first Ironman. Well, I did my first two Ironmans in May. Well, April and May of 2019, whilst I was recovering from the knee injury before the lunges, the 13 hours and the ultra. So that was my first dabbles with ultra full distance triathlons. Did the Lanzarote Ironman in May of 2019. Did a self-supported one before that as well. So I'd done full distance triathlon, and then the Keltman came along, which is an extreme Scottish triathlon, which is 3.4K swim and shield ag, a 202K bike around Shield Ag, Kinlochhue, and then basically a loop around the North Coast 500, and then 42.2K over basically Ben Eye, which is the Munro range in Torridon. So 42.2K over two Munros, which is just disgusting, really. But I was training for that at the time. So I was up at 4:30 every day in London, getting on a bus because the trains weren't even running yet, into the Nuffield Health in Moorgate. Swimming, training, running, watt bike, whatever there, and then into the office, and then second training session most evenings. And then that was Monday, Thursday was very, very full on. And then Friday was, I tried to keep training free. No, Friday morning I'd train at Lyft, and then spend Friday evening with Erin. Saturday morning I was in the hills, and that was what I was doing.
When did you become the hybrid athlete then? Was it the Ironman, would you say?
I'd say it happened after the Ironman, because I was lifting again. It kind of happened by accident, training for those three events in November 2019, because my training was basically supporting, I was balancing concurrent charity goals. One was an ultra running thing, the other one was the lunging, which required top end strength and the ability to maintain that over X amount of time. So I was back to squatting about 180 kilos, but also running 30 miles at the weekend.
What would be your definition of the hybrid athlete then? It's hard to put a pin on, isn't it?
Balancing concurrent disciplines that seemingly don't speak to one another, I'd say. So, for example, running doesn't complement strength. Running doesn't complement your back squat, and your back squat doesn't necessarily complement running linearly, but to perform in both of them at a decent level. So it's balancing disciplines that aren't necessarily
complementary.
Yeah, I'd say so. It's a flagrant term. It could be anything. You make of it what you mean. It could just mean doing two things at once, but I think that the phrase it's come to know in the UK is that, but the... Yeah, 2020, so obviously everything flipped. Went home, was working and living in Dalry, and then lockdown one happened, so we went down to my parents in Hoylake in the northwest, because there was a gym. So we've got a gym at home, which Jamie and I have had for about 6 years there. And yeah, at that point I pivoted and thought, right, I'll keep training for the Keltman as if it's going to happen. Then it didn't. It was decided it wasn't happening. And then... I'd always had in the back of my mind, because it had been spoken about at CrossFit Level 1 for a long time, the 500-pound squat and sub-5-minute mile. And I'd always thought, that's something I've got in the bank at some point in my life, but there's no rush. Just keep it on the back burner. Have it on the list. There is a list. I do have a list. It's in my iPhone notes. And then there was a post about it on Garage Gym Reviews, being like, who's going to be the first person to do it? And somebody had tried, and they'd run like a 5:18 mile. I was like, oh, that's not bad. It's not bad. The squat was a grinder as well. And I thought, nobody's close. And then in the comments, it turned out there were a few people that had sort of like, people thought were close. And then it turned out there was this gym in Virginia that was going for it. And I thought, all right, well, if people are actually going for it, and I feel like I'm capable of it, I might as well try and throw my hat in the ring if there is a bit of a race now. So tested it. I squatted 220 for an absolute RPE 14 rep. And then...
Redhead. Yeah. Vein popping.
It was bad, mate. It was bad. It was about a 6 second rep. And then ran a 507 mile with a tailwind. So that was in the set. That was a Wednesday and the Friday. I thought, well, that's close enough. I'll give it a go. So then put all my eggs in that basket of, well, all my eggs plus the endurance stuff on the Saturdays for an event I was training for later in the year, and started training for that. So I basically did a 2 4-week training cycles for 500 pound squat and sub 5 minute mile. And then the guy from Virginia did it the week before I did, just because of the way our training cycles unfolded. It looked like he wasn't going to do it, so I'd sort of planned my timing around that, and then he sort of just went for it and managed to get there because his plantar fasciitis was flaring up, so we thought, if I don't do it now, I won't be able to. But then, yeah, the following week on the Sunday, I squatted 500 pounds in the morning and ran a 458 mile about 3 hours later, and then, because somebody had done it before me, I thought I'd run a marathon as well. But that was where I sort of made a bit of a, not a name for myself, but there was the CrossFit Games wrote about me, shared it all. Men's Health Global did an article about it. Bar Ben did an article about it. And it was sort of, yeah, it put me in that space where I can balance hybrid disciplines at a decent level across the board without being especially good at any one of them.
You've said that so casually. I just chucked a marathon on the end of it.
It was a very slow marathon because I was absolutely minced. 8 weeks before, I'd run a 3:17 marathon at like 165 heart rate. So not red line, but a decent effort. I think I'd probably be good for 3:10 at best. I ran like a 4:55 marathon on the day because I was the mile. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the video, but the mile, I was rolling around like Stewie from Family Guy when they're drinking that medicine. I was 30 minutes on the floor, throwing my guts up. No concept of how I was ever going to move again. Like, my body had just shut down. And then I thought, oh, I've got to drive everyone back to Edinburgh as well. So physiologically I was ruined. So I knew going into the mile it was going to be tough, but cramps and everything were just brutal at that point, to the point where I had to slow down.
But you almost feel you have to do these like more and more, I don't want to say bonkers, but more and more extreme challenges to generate conversation, which is the aim, and also generate fundraising for.
Yeah, I mean, that was separate in the sense that was a personal goal that people became invested in. And okay. I never wanted it to be like me versus the American guy. At one point I thought it'd be fun to make it like that, but then thought, I don't really care. It's something that no one's ever done. It's a good opportunity for me to prove myself, I guess, as an athlete, which will then in turn prop up the future charity stuff that I do, rather than being necessarily completely interlinked. Because, I mean, I could have been like, oh, I'm doing this for this cause, but I wasn't. I was doing it because I wanted to squat 500 pounds and run a sub 5 minute mile because I thought I was capable of it. So to try and conflate those two would have been disingenuous of me. And I'm very, I mean, my number one virtue, my number one guiding principle is authenticity now. And if I was to try and shoehorn something in off the back of that, it would have been disingenuous.
Yeah, fair. I can see that. And I think you're living authentically when it comes to that. One of the questions I've got for you is, what are you thinking about during these challenges? It may differ between different modalities, so running versus lifting, but what is the self-talk? What's going through your head?
It's ever-changing. It's ever-changing. But what I will say is, I refer to this a lot, but at one point, when my brother's a cricketer, and he trains like an animal, but at one point he did 60 minutes on the watt bike at the house, and this was when I was a strength athlete, and he came through to kitchen having done 60 minutes static on the watt bike. And I was like, how in the world can anybody possibly sit there for 60 minutes and just do the same modality at a steady pace? Fast forward 3 years later and I've ran 94 miles in 22 hours and 50 minutes, and it's all this incremental building. It's progressive overload is all it is. Like I constantly remind myself that at one point in my life this was impossible, yet here I am doing six times what you once thought would have been just about killed you. And when I'm suffering, I want to have faith in the programming and the process, because I won't go into anything blind. I think people in the fitness industry as well, there seems to have been this weird tendency over lockdown to do challenges without doing any prep, thinking that that's a good thing to do, and then falling short and wondering why. Well, it's because you didn't, like, you can't just run an ultra in the same way that you can't just squat 500 pounds. Like,
there needs to be training for it, tapering ahead.
Without wanting to criticize one corner of the fitness community too much, there was a bit of a tendency of people that sort of sat on the rowing machine occasionally thinking that they just had these unbelievable engines, which is discrediting the physiological adaptation required to be efficient in these things, in the same way that a runner can't just squat 180 kilos because he wants to think, or he's stubborn enough to squat 180 kilos. That's not how it works. But I think that, I mean, that's the bigger part of what I like to do, in the sense that I want people to explore training new ways and building out the process and the experience. And that's what, that the experience is the key word there. Because whenever I come to being in the bin, redlining, whatever it is, sleep deprived, in pain, all this stuff, it's not something I've done on a whim. There's meaning behind it. There's reason behind it, whether that's personal, whether it's community based. There is a bigger guiding principle than just doing it for the sake of doing it. And that's why I go back to that. If it's ego driven, it doesn't work. And you'll very quickly find this out. If anybody tries to run 100 miles because they think it'll be good for their YouTube channel, or because they think it'll get them more clients, it's not going to happen.
On a smaller scale, Fergus, you see it on Instagram where somebody's like, I'm going to prep for a bodybuilding show, and they're doing it because they think it'll get them more online clients. Yeah. So they're doing it because, oh, I'll get more likes on Instagram or more followers. And you're like, well, actually, there's going to come a point where that's quite hard. It's not going to be as hard as, well, I don't know, subjectively, people will say it's maybe harder. But
they're different challenges, aren't they? Yeah.
But there'll come a point where your hunger is extreme. There'll come a point where your energy level's terrible. There'll come a point where your training is absolutely shit and you're like 3 weeks out from this show. And if your like reason why is poor or not like wholesome, then you inevitably fail. Whereas
you lose every time.
You're coming from a place where, like you say, you either choose it from a personal perspective or a community perspective, and it's authentically a decision that you've made yourself, not just because you're like, oh, well, I'll get another 1,000 views on YouTube if I run this marathon at the end of this challenge.
It's all a byproduct. It's all a byproduct for me. I'm now in the position where social media and the YouTube side of things it helps with all the bigger stuff going on, but I've never really focused on metrics. Like my growth tracking is not focused on the arbitrary metrics of social media numbers and all this stuff. It's focused on actual meaningful figures. So the fundraising, but more importantly, the people impacted. And we set up an email account for Project Vertical in 2020, which had 633 emails in. That's 633 people that have taken the time to send a message from, hey guys, hope you're okay, amazing what you're doing, really big fan, cheers, Gary. Two, we had one that was 1,900 words, an email that was sat down 1,900 words long explaining their evolution from following me from session from challenge number one through to now, and seeing what's developed, just how that's tracked in line with their personal journey. Fucking who cares about social media numbers or any of that shit when that's coming through? That's why, and I need to remember as well, it's all a choice. Everything I'm doing is completely a choice. And if I'm thinking about quitting halfway through when I'm in the bin, what's the point in having started? And I also know the lessons that I've learned from those moments when I've had those mental battles. Every single time that I come out the other end, I'm better off for it.
What's the closest you've come to quitting, Ferguson? What did you have to say to yourself to make it through?
I think there's two elements. One was a physiological thing, in the sense that the final 140 meters of the mile, with 140 meters to go, at that point, I thought, up until that point, I would have told you that was my physiological 10 out of 10. And I was faced with the reality that I had 140 meters to go. So somehow just a decision was made at that point, being like, you can count it here. You've given it your all, or you can just hold on and see how long you can. And I managed to hold on for another 140 meters to the point where the second I stopped, my body just shut down, like lactic. I couldn't move. I was throwing up. It was a complete red line. That was true 10 out of 10. So the decision I had there was, my perception of limit was hit, but the willingness to explore beyond that was just from a place of see what happens. So I didn't necessarily think quit here. But the point that I would have previously referenced as my quitting point was a threshold that I surpassed.
You hadn't explored that yet. You hadn't reached it.
No. But I think from an actual quitting point of view, I think the Glasgow to Edinburgh Ultra, first time I did it. So that was my first sleep deprived. So it was October, mid-October. I got on the 9:15 train from Haymarket through, seeing students next to me drinking, being like, fucking, I'm coming back on foot. and like watching them be like, I'd rather just be having a pint now. But anyway, got off 10. It was 10 till 8, 8:15. I ran from basically the Union Canal the whole way through. And about 30 miles in, because I was completely self-supported, had all my water on me. I had like 9 kilos of additional weight that hadn't been used in my training up until that point. So 30 yeah. miles in, I felt like I'd ran 50 miles. And then I started to get into that real negative self-talk. Oh, you've made a mistake. You've miscalculated here. Maybe you should just call it short. And that 30 miles with the weight will equal the equivalent of 54 miles. But now a huge part of the training that we do with clients as well is that the part of the trial runs and the stuff is actually familiarizing with the environment, learning what that weight equals, learning how to fuel, learning when to eat, learning what to drink, learning how to carry it most effectively, learning that actually when you get to this junction, make sure you look left so a car doesn't hit you. And that like little things like that, that people discount when it comes to training. Training is preparation. And
it's beyond the physical.
Exactly. But I was purely in the mindset of, physically, I'm flagging, therefore this is over. Whereas there was still 24 miles of exploration and learnings for me to be had. So, I got through it because, one, it was 3 a.m. and I didn't have anyone to call. But two, because I searched, when I was in Falkirk, I searched a taxi number. And I hit call, it rang once, and I closed it and thought, nah. Crack on.
Was that close to almost actioning?
That was the closest.
Given that exercise has formed such a large part of your life up until this point, and you're continuing to push yourself forward and explore the realms of what is possible, what role does it play day to day in your well-being?
It's an anchor. It's a predictable part of my day, and it's a trackable metric that keeps me feel like I'm moving forwards, even if other elements of my life are moving backwards. So my training is very rigid, very meticulous, very analytical, to the point where if somebody says, oh, do you want to come on a 50 mile with me on the bike, or do you want to do a Metcon with me and my mates at this CrossFit gym, I say no, because it doesn't fit the program, and the balancing concurrent goals requires meticulous application.
How far ahead are you planning?
We'll build out sort of 12 weeks at a time, but then take it day by day. And if I have a terrible night's sleep, if 200 kilos on a squat one day feels like 20% harder than it should do, then we'll adjust the plan. But it's we set a framework and then we take it moving forwards. But it's very dependent on systemic fatigue, very dependent upon perception of fatigue, very dependent upon external stresses. Because I mean, I'm very, very stressed with my professional life at the moment, which is having an impact on my training. And sometimes the worst thing that I can do on a Monday is send it around the track for 12 by 400 meters when I've had a mad stressful day, because systemically all that's going to do is tank me even further. So we need to rethink. But that's where most people go wrong when trying to balance strength and endurance goals, is that they either A, bolt 100% of a running program and 100% of a lifting program and put them together. You do the maths, that doesn't work. Or they feel that they need to be training all the time to be able to manage it, when in reality you only have so much adaptive energy each week. If you're overspilling that, you're not going to adapt, and you're just going to be perpetually tanking yourself, and you're not going to move forward. So I'm just trying to constantly hit that point where I'm progressing, adapting. But from my point of view, from a day-to-day, I mean, I'm paid by some people as an athlete. I have partnerships with brands. I have partnerships with even races now that are, they're media spots, I guess, but I need to take it seriously as
responsibility. Yeah, and exactly. You respond well to responsibility.
I do, but it's also a stress, because it adds the layer of pressure. Is it's not a hobby where I get to do things on my own terms. I can't just sack off a training session because I'm stressed. It's sacking off a training session is like missing a day of work. You can't just not show up for work one day. So for me, it requires planning as well. I mean, previous two weekends I was up in Torridon Friday night, Saturday, Sunday camping. That's 6 hours, give or take, of planning, sorting everything, cleaning my bike, doing mechanicals, making sure I've got everything, ordering spares off the internet, checking my tent, finding my tent, getting stuff out of the attic, getting it all laid out, double checking, getting in the car, driving up, getting started and staying over, realizing there's a last check-in time, so I couldn't stay in Inverness, all this stuff. And it's easy to think, I mean, I fell into the trap with that as well. It's easy to think it's just a training session. But I left it until Friday afternoon to prep for that, because I was like, all right, box off your work, leave the gap, get it done, get in the car. But that meant that I deprioritized the training, deprioritized the prep, which meant that it fell down the pecking order, which meant that I was rushed, stressed, packing and prepping for it, which meant I went into the training session suboptimal in terms of mindset. So
performance was impacted?
No, because once I was moving, I was fine, but I was in the car and I had a lot of time to think about how much I actually would rather not be doing this right now. And then I start to think, well, maybe actually that's a sign that you should drop the volume a little bit because this could end up ruining you. But it's part of the plan, and sometimes I need the training to ruin me and I need to take a step back from the work stuff because that's part of who I am now. I'm not saying for anyone in other jobs that's the same thing, but I'm balancing two jobs there in a sense.
Yeah.
But at the moment, with everything going on, laying the foundations of the businesses, etc., I'm finding that I'm deprioritizing the training. Well, I'm always doing it, and I'm always doing it to the prescribed level, but I'm not doing it at the time. I'm not giving the priority points in my day where I know I'm most effective to it. Which means that I then start to think, well, is your performance hindered as a result of this? Could you be doing things better? But if you're doing things better, could you be giving your all to this side of the business? And it's an ongoing, it's something that I'm going to deal with. But day to day, it's a part of the day job, which means it requires planning, prep, thought, visualization, checking, triple checking, and knowing all. I mean, triathlon alone is a stupid sport. The amount of stuff you need for it: wetsuits, gloves, goggles, chamois cream.
You don't choose easy things to do, do you?
Tri suits, heart rate monitors, Garmins, then the bike, spares, tubes, CO2 canisters, tire levers, gels, bananas, water at the front, replacement water bottles, make sure your helmet's sorted, make sure you've got a different lens for your sunglasses, all this stuff's mad. And it requires a lot of thinking, and thinking is mental energy. And I'm very much on the boundary of how much mental energy I've got left to give at the moment, which is something I'm conscious of and I know is not sustainable. But without the exercise, without those other goals outside of the monotonous day-to-day goals, I'm more effective being stretched by the exercise than I would be not doing it at all. Because I know it's what's a good analogy? I'm trying to think. If you're cooking a meal and you're putting separate elements together towards an end, you need to give each element, let's think of an example. Beef Wellington, you need to make sure that the beef's looked after first of all. You need to make sure that the pastry is well done. You need to make sure that the filling that goes around the beef is put together properly. You can't half-arse each three elements and expect the finished product to be excellent. You need to give each one the correct attention, yeah.
Concentrate on the meat.
Exactly. There's a bit to read into that as you will. Depends on the time of the day, I guess. But it's a case of giving each one the right focus at the right time and making sure that then the finished product comes out as best it can. And you only get there through doing that over time. And Beef Wellington's only as useful as it is with the pastry, in the same way that it's only as useful as it is with the filling, and it's only as useful as it is with the beef. And if I drop the training, I'd be less useful in other elements of my life. So I'm conscious of that, but I know that if I give too much attention to any individual discipline, then it'll start to hinder the other. And the more that one is hindered, then the more it'll hinder the others. So it's a constant balancing act between the different elements of what I do. But I say again, I'm very lucky that I'm quite self-aware with it as a result of the experiences I've had.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I can give any advice for each individual other than sharing the experience that I've had on it, and that there's certain things that I believe are consistently valuable for us as all as individuals. Habits, discipline, setting structures, setting the right training programs in place, understanding your limitations, understanding what makes you happy, what is good for you, and actually focusing and over-indexing on those things, I think is very important. And I'm far from perfect on it. You'll find me on a Sunday almost paralyzed by stress, paralyzed by how on earth I'm going to get through the next week. I mean, I'm 12 days out from the Keltman now, and I haven't even given a second of thought about how I'm starting to prep for it. And last night, I started getting a bit stressed about the fact that I hadn't been thinking about it proactively.
Yeah.
Because I felt like I can easily fall behind. That's 12 days ahead, because I know how much I've got to get done between now and then from a work point of view.
Yeah, I was getting this booked in was...
Yeah.
Hard, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's difficult.
And your travel around that is a lot to pour on top of it. Yeah. I think to really help the listeners a little bit, we can scale some of what you do. So what are some of the anchors that you've got? So you've exercised an anchor,
yep,
that holds you steady, and it's a constant, and it needs to be there for well-being, but also to tick the box to move towards where you want to go. Yep. What are a couple of the others?
So relationships. I mean, mine is Erin, my girlfriend. She's very valuable, understands me. Soundboard for a lot of stuff, and isn't afraid to sort of fight back on anything that might not be sensible. I might be overexcited about or underexcited about. The dogs are a part of that, obviously. There's a second one now. Player 2 enters the game.
Odie and who else?
Harley. Cockapoo. They're good pals. But spending time outdoors with them, spending time outdoors, full stop. So making sure that my training is done outdoors as frequently as possible. I think over the winter, we had turbo trainer, treadmill. When it was really snowy, I was doing all my training on the treadmill, all my training on the turbo, and I did start to feel pretty... I don't even know the word. I just felt flat.
Your mood is worse because you're not getting natural light.
Yeah, and it's what's funny is it's a realization that goes dormant as well, because I mean, previously I'd used to say if I didn't spend a weekend in the hills, I'd be worse off for it. Whereas I was training for, I mean, early this year, I was just slowly building bike volume, slowly building running volume. I actually got dragged into a 12-hour max distance run until March, so I ended up training for what was 56 miles, I think I ran in March, just on, not on a whim, but with like 2 months of prep. Not even that, it's 4 weeks of prep. So with 4 weeks of prep, ended up doing that. So I was just pounding tarmac. And I just missed that. And then on the way up to Torridon, I was thinking, oh, I can't be arsed, it's such a long drive, go, all this, all that. And then you get up to the Highlands, you're like, fucking, who cares about anything else now? That's it. But I needed, even though I know that, and I'll tell other people that, I needed psychologically reminded of how much I have to gain from being in those environments. So that's a big anchor. Social life is something I'm under indexing on at the moment because of the fact that I don't feel like I have any space to slot it in. But moving into an office on Tuesday in the city centre of Edinburgh means that I'm hoping I can factor in a few more
lunch meetings or something like that.
Even if it's just, hey, how are you doing? Tell me what you're up to. Because I saw some people the other day and they were like, we haven't seen you since October. I was like, fuck, has it been that long? And I haven't even thought about it. Like, it was just because I haven't had time to think since then. I haven't even thought about it. So that's that. Food, drink, like simple life pleasures. I make sure to not get stuck in the monotony of not enjoying food. I mean, I still track all my food, but I'm nothing like I used to be. I'm very fluid with it.
Your numbers are so high as well. There's freedom within that.
But I need to be, my actual BMR is very low for my body weight and output. Yeah. Yeah. So when I'm dieting, I'll need to be down as low as 2200 base. And then I eat back 90% of what I burn from CV work. But you'd expect me to be at about a 2,500 maintenance according to the numbers online. But I know that I need to be a bit lower. Yeah. So that's it's something I manifest. It's something I make sure to get right. But I don't. I have a very, very healthy relationship with MyFitnessPal now. It's a tool for tracking rather than
a Bible,
the holy power. Yeah. And then, I mean, the training's the obvious one, and then fulfillment, passion, enjoying what I do on a day-to-day basis. And I've never been someone that, if you give me a task to do that I don't understand, I won't be able to do it effectively because my brain just doesn't turn on. It doesn't show up. Whereas if I'm passionate about something, if I understand the purpose, if I can build out a bit of a strategy and a bigger picture thinking around it, then I'll go all in. And that's what I'm doing now. So I'm very happy to be doing that. But for context, it's been 3 years in a professional environment underpinning that financially and sort of to pay the bills principally, but knowing that I have to keep building everything in the background steadily, patiently. But I've only got as far as I did at doing that because it was something I was genuinely passionate about and genuinely enjoyed. So I think... I guess you could call it a side hustle that turned into a full-time career. But at the end of the day, it was a passion project that became a full-time career. And I think the hustle culture mentality is toxic because I've just used that word toxic. It sounds very BuzzFeed-y.
Yeah.
But negative, I'll rephrase, just to avoid BuzzFeed UK clickbait. I think I think Gary Vee's full of shit. I think to summarize, discredits relationships, discredits spending time with people, just focuses on hustle, money, what you can build, etc. In reality, as human beings, that's not how we're wired, that's not how we work, and we're more effective as human beings when we're happier, we're more productive when we're happier, and we're happier when we're spending more time with people that we like spending time with, doing the things that we enjoy doing. And if you're hustling for something that is purely a means to an end, i.e. financially, you're only going to get so far. It's the same as me on a run in the sense that if I was 30 miles into a 54 miler and I didn't have a bigger picture at that point, when I phoned the taxi in Falkirk, I would have gotten the taxi.
That was the exact example I was going to come back at you with there, because it's nice that you've got that alignment within your head to say, oh, well, it's exactly the same as this because I've experienced this. And again, we're going back to experience rather than you coming at people from a soapbox.
Yeah, that's it. And I think in my past, I've explored ways of making money on the side, but they don't stick unless it's easy money. But it's very difficult to make easy money without doing lots of work. Very difficult to, unless it's bending the rules. But you can't work hard unless you want to work hard for it. And you can only want to work hard for it if it's something you're passionate about or enjoy. And yes, you can be passionate about making money, but those people tend to be in cycles of, not fads, but in these cycle, these sprint projects. I'm going to try and make money here. Okay, I've got a little bit. I'm going to try and put it there and do it that way. And I don't know. I enjoy sustained passion over time because I feel like it makes me a more.
Well, you're process driven, aren't you? So
yeah.
So I think most of the people that listen to self development podcasts like this one are elements of their personality will be process driven. So a lot of what we've spoken about will tick their boxes. And I think we've covered a tremendous amount, Fergus. And I know there's more that we could certainly cover in a round two if we get the opportunity to, if we can fit it into both our busy diaries. But for those that want to connect with you further off the back of this, where's the best place for them to go?
Yep. So Instagram is at Fergus Crawley. No, anything else other than my name. YouTube's Fergus Crawley. Shock horror. The podcast is The Modern Mind, and the Instagram for that is at The Modern Mind UK. Omnia Performance is where we run all of our coaching through, and the website is www.omnia-performance.com. And yeah, most of what I do is on Instagram and YouTube. I've been running a sort of episode-by-episode breakdown of how I'm approaching the Keltman from every angle, so you can see a bit more about how I train, how I approach things, what kit I require, what it looks like in terms of training around Edinburgh, etc. But yeah, the podcast is a great place to engage as well, because it's where I have most of my long form conversations with some amazing guests so far.
Yeah, amazing, Fergus. All that will be linked in the show notes below. Hopefully you've all enjoyed that one. If you're on YouTube and you're new here, please hit the subscribe button. If you're on Apple Podcasts, then please leave a 5-star review and let us know what you thought of the conversation with Fergus. And lastly, if you're not using either of those platforms, take a screenshot, pop in your Instagram story, tag me at call.cambro, tag Fergus at Fergus Crawley, and I'll be back to speak to you all again very, very soon.